the economic importance of the Connecticut River.
Water power was New England's first contribution to industrial development. Industrial development began in New England because of the water power.
That's historian Dr. Cary Buckley. We talked to him about the influence of the Connecticut River on the early American Industrial Revolution.
You know, I knew how his story ended because I had grown up familiar with hearing about the company. I knew that he built this company that had become so successful. It was one of the largest silk mills in the world. Hearing about that success made me appreciate what he was able to do after the flood, because when the Mill River flood occurred on May 16, 1874, William Skinner lost absolutely everything in 15 minutes. And he was 49 years old, and he had to figure out, what was he going to do? How is he going to come back? How could he rebuild his company if he could rebuild it?
That's writer Sarah Skinner Kilborn talking about her great-grandfather in her book American Phoenix, The Remarkable Story of William Skinner, a man who turned disaster into destiny.
We also just have to look at the kinds of communities that have developed along the river. And despite the decline, despite the economic devastation in some of these communities, we still have some strong community forces and a strong workforce. And we've had, you know, really from the very beginning of this and an early industrial revolution and before, experiments at innovation and alternatives.
Finally, we talked to sociologist and musician Professor Tom Jurevich about the decline of industrialization along the Connecticut River. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Drew Adamack. Welcome to the third episode of The River Runs Through Us, our special six-part series exploring the literature, spirit, and meaning of the Connecticut River in Massachusetts. Today, we explore the economic influence of the Connecticut River on the early American Industrial Revolution, take a long look into the life of one of the men who shaped that revolution, and talk about what's next in this era of deindustrialization. The Connecticut River is the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution. Its tributaries and canals provided the clean, cheap, and inexhaustible power and easy transportation that industries like timber, textiles, agriculture, and manufacturing needed to survive. Towns like Greenfield, Holyoke, Northampton, and Hartford grew up and thrived around the Connecticut River. To understand how the Connecticut River shaped the early American economy and industrial arts, I talked with author and historian Dr. Cary Buckley about the economic development of the Connecticut River. Dr. Buckley is the author of A Place Called Paradise, Culture and Community in Northampton, Massachusetts. He is also the executive director of Historic Northampton. This is an excerpt of a larger interview I conducted with Dr. Buckley last fall. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Buckley.
I'm glad to be here.
How and why did industrialization take place along the banks of the Connecticut River in early colonial America?
Well, the river was kind of the life for trade up until the Revolution, consisting mostly of agricultural products, of cattle and wheat and flax. So this did a number of things. It facilitated trade, certainly, but it also made it economically feasible for factories to be developed along the tributaries of the Connecticut River. Water power was New England's first contribution to industrial development. Industrial development began in New England because of the water power. And you had people like Levi Shepard, who was an apothecary before the Revolution. And after the Revolution, he invested his profits not in land, as the pre-revolutionary elites did, but in manufactures. And he built one of the first woolen factories along the Mill River, and it was huge. It employed 200 people. It was capitalized at $100,000. And the Industrial Revolution began in tributaries like the Mill River, 25 or 30 years before Lawrence and Lowell were ever conceived. So you begin to have startups like this along the tributaries, the Mill River, for instance. You had woolen factories, button factories, paper mills, daguerreotype case makers. Eventually, the silk industry developed along this So water power and water as a means of transportation was extremely important to the development of economic development of the valley, and really sparked the Industrial Revolution. And the railroad, of course, just expanded the opportunities.
The river seems to have gone through several cycles, sort of boom and bust cycles, first with fur trading and then the salmon and shad and then forestry. Is that an accurate description of how the river has sort of economically been important, is that it's had these boom and bust periods?
Well, you might say that. You know, just like the towns along the Connecticut River had their booms and bust periods. Certainly, industrialization shaped the towns along the river. The old river ports gave way to new towns like Holyoke, and Chicopee became an industrial center. And as industry left, you had derelict factories, unused infrastructure, certainly a bust period. As there were those that began to see an opportunity to use that infrastructure to sort of transform it, to use it for other purposes. The architecture and the facilities were transformed for 20th and 21st century use for new companies, for artists. Some of the downtowns were transformed. But the emphasis on technology today, in a sense, is sort of follows the path of the railroad. The technology corridor that's being developed with fiber optics basically follows the path of the railroad from New Haven up through the valley. And it's kind of interesting that the railroads are coming back. Just yesterday, it was announced that Connecticut received the federal grant to build a high-speed rail from New Haven up to the Connecticut River, to the Connecticut-Massachusetts border. Amtrak is being rerouted to include Northampton all the way to Vermont. It will certainly transform this area in terms of making it extending essentially metro north from the New York area into the region. And I must say it's interesting that the Connecticut River Valley has always been oriented north and south rather than east and west, mainly because of river access, the trade relationships and so forth, the historic relationships have been north and south, more of a connection with New York than Boston, really.
The physical structure of the river makes it unique in America in the sense that there's not a major city at its mouth.
Right.
There's no New Orleans on the Connecticut River. Did it make New England more egalitarian or more equal in that it spread the wealth in some ways because there wasn't a concentration at the mouth?
Well, that's a good question. I think before the Revolution, the wealth was really rooted in the land itself. The so-called river gods acquired the choicest land. They intermarried with one another. They were the ministers, the magistrates, the great landowners. And certainly there was a wealth gap. But it didn't show as much in commercial centers because there was a kind of a connection of reciprocal debt between the landowners and those who worked the land. Debts were carried over from one year to the other. The landowner would usually give the debtor a bit of slack. Debts were paid in kind, firewood or labor or produce. So the landowner was kind of the lender of first resort, and there was a reciprocal relationship that was a bond, a sense of community and responsibility that didn't exist in more commercial centers where the exchange was more of a market exchange. But that did change as industrialization developed in the valley. And when factories were built, labor was exchanged for cash, creating a laboring class that was dependent on the manufacturer. And before that, one of the reasons why Shays Rebellion occurred in the late 18th century was because the Boston merchants wanted to collect debts in cash because they were being pressed by British creditors. And it was really the first incursion of a market economy on basically a barter economy. And the valley farmers, of course, were used to paying their taxes in kind. And when they couldn't do that, their houses were foreclosed. And so they essentially decided to initiate their own revolution and marched upon the Springfield Armory to take possession of the armaments there. Of course, they were defeated. But, however, they sparked reform, an easing of the debt situation. In terms of equality, New England has been more of a kind of leveled society because most people, as George Washington noted, as he traveled through New England, were sort of the middling type. They were artisans. They might be merchants. The kind of wealth that was accumulated commercial centers wasn't reflected in the lifestyle of the wealthy classes in the Connecticut Valley.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Buckley.
Thank you.
In the 19th century, one of the most important industries to emerge in the Connecticut River Valley was the silk industry in Northampton and Holyoke. William Skinner is perhaps the most influential of those textile manufacturers. Francesca Rhiannon talks to his great-granddaughter, Sarah Skinner Kilborn, about her book American Phoenix, the remarkable story of William Skinner, a man who turned disaster into destiny, to learn more about the forces that shaped his life and the economy of the Connecticut River Valley.
Sarah Kilborn, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's wonderful to talk to you.
And I should say Sarah Skinner Kilborn because you are actually a descendant of the subject of this story, William Skinner. This is the remarkable story of William Skinner, a man who turned disaster into destiny in this book, American Phoenix. Did you grow up with some of these stories when you were a kid?
That's a great question. And a lot of people ask me that because they think, well, you've just written a book about your ancestor. You must have grown up hearing about him. And as you noted earlier, my middle name is Skinner, and I'm actually named after William Skinner's second wife. You know, I knew how his story ended because I had grown up familiar with hearing about the company. I knew that he built this company that had become so successful. It was one of the largest silk mills in the world. And hearing about that success made me appreciate what he was able to do after the flood, because when the Mill River flood occurred on May 16, 1874, William Skinner lost absolutely everything in 15 minutes. And he was 49 years old, and he had to figure out, what was he going to do? How is he going to come back? How could he rebuild his company if he could rebuild it?
It is absolutely spellbinding story that you tell in this book, American Phoenix. I hardly know where to start. Love to start with the disaster itself, but I think I'm going to hold off for a minute because I want you to tell us more about your great-great-grandfather, William Skinner. He became probably one of the wealthiest individuals in the United States at the time that he was alive, and yet he was born into, one might say, incredibly humble origins.
He was born into a community of silk workers, and they had been making silk for generations. But they were so poor and malnourished that they were called a stunted, puny race. The poverty in this section of East London called Spitalfields, which today is a very posh neighborhood, but in the 1820s, it was abject poverty. He came over to America at the age of 20, and that was, I can only imagine, a very powerful decision. And it turned out, of course, to be an extremely significant one. But when he left, he was the oldest of seven children. And he was admittedly one of the, if not the largest breadwinner in his family. He was a silk dyer. He had been working since the age of four. So by the age of 20, he was a master silk dyer. He was making money that was helping to support his family. If he left, not only left Spitalfields, but left the country, there was a good chance he would never see or talk to his family again. Immigration in the 19th century was a form of death. It was a virtual exile. And Skinner came to this country. He had absolutely nothing of any material value whatsoever. But he did have one thing of extreme value that no American had at the time, and that was a knowledge of how to dye silk.
So tell us a little bit about the history of silk. What was going on here? I mean, first of all, where was America in terms of the silk manufacturing business? How come there were no dyers here? And how come there were dyers in Spitalfields?
the art of manufacturing silk, you know, has originated in China about 2600 BC, and gradually spread from China through Europe and then over to England. And it had yet to make its way to America. The young democracy had no silk industry. We didn't know how to make it. We didn't know how to manufacture it. Didn't know what the machinery looked like. Had no concept of how to dye silk, how to make a black that would last, that wouldn't rub off on your skin or flake at the slightest touch. And, you know, these are domestic and industrial arts that had been passed down through the centuries in Europe and in the Far East. So Skinner, having grown up in this community of silk workers in England, he was steeped in the traditions of how to make and manufacture silk. And when he arrived in this country, he brought what Americans didn't have. He brought some of what Americans didn't have. So that gave him an opportunity right off the bat. And he established first a successful dyeing business for himself. And there were a few mills in the area. There were many, the most of them were localized in New England, and several were in the Northampton, Florence area. So what he did was he started dyeing silks for these very fledgling silk mills that were trying to figure out how to make a silk product that could rival silks coming in from Europe and England. And Skinner became one of the founding members of the American silk industry. He helped build that silk industry in this country.
So why was, you know, a fairly significant portion of the early silk manufacturing industry located in the Northampton area on the Mill River in Massachusetts? The Mill River is a tributary to the Great Connecticut River.
A man named Samuel Whitmarsh came to Northampton, and he had this idea of creating a factory that would make silk from the moth to the cloth. And what Americans originally started doing 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries is they were trying to make the raw silk first, and then manufacture our own raw silk into silk fabric, silk cloth. And Americans were unable to figure out how to do it successfully. But Whitmarsh had established a silk growing farm in Northampton, and that generated considerable interest. Again, because here was this opportunity for Americans to get in on the silk business. If we could figure out how to do it, Americans could make a lot of money. So Whitmarsh's establishment drew an intense amount of attention, and that inspired other people within the area to think about making silk. And because there were so few individuals at this time engaged in this kind of work, it benefited them to be near each other.
William Skinner's first factory was established on the Mill River. He built a town around the plant, a town called Skinnerville. Alas, the town was fated to have a short life, swept away in a catastrophic flood in 1874. So now describe to us what Skinnerville was like before this huge wall of water hit.
Skinnerville was a beautiful, lovely little village. And it was a thriving industrial village. Skinner had established a mill there, his silk mill there, in the 1850s. And, you know, by 1874, there was a thriving silk mill community that had grown up around his mill. He had one of the largest silk mills in the state. And when he moved to this area, there were a few farmhouses here and there, but there was no village. So his industry really created a community of people that were living and working together. The farmers in the area were farming, and their children were working in the mill, helping to contribute to their family's income.
And these were good jobs. These weren't the kind of dark, satanic mills of Charles Dickens fame.
Correct. And that was one of the things that does set, at this time, small factory villages like Skinner's apart from the industrial centers of England.
We're talking with Sarah S. Kilborn. That S stands for Skinner. Sarah Kilborn is the great-great-granddaughter of the subject of her remarkable book. It's called American Phoenix, The Remarkable Story of William Skinner, A Man Who Turned Disaster into Destiny. And we're getting close to the disaster part here because we come to the Mill River. Describe the scene.
On the morning of May 16, 1874, George Cheney, the gatekeeper of the dam, was sitting down to breakfast with his family, and his father looked out the window and saw a chunk of the dam slough off and pass away downstream. And he immediately shouted to his son to go check on the dam, look at the dam. And George ran out. He noticed that water was already beginning to percolate through the exposed earth, and he opened up the sluice pipe to try to relieve pressure on the dam, and then immediately jumped onto his horse and raced 3 miles down the valley to the nearest town, Williamsburg, to alert his boss, the general manager of the dam, Onslow Spellman, that he thought the dam was giving way. And Spellman doesn't believe Cheney and says, well, if you really believe that the dam is giving way, then you go yourself warn the people below. And Cheney was exasperated. He couldn't ride his horse any further. The horse was spent. A milkman, a dairy farmer, rode into town about that time and, you know, was so struck by the appearance of the gatekeeper. The dairy farmer named Collins Graves said, I'll go warn the people below. You warn the folks here in Williamsburg. I'll go warn the people below. They all thought that they had plenty of time to do all this warning. They assumed that, well, the reservoir was filled with 600 million gallons of water. It covered 111 acres. It was going to take a long time for that water to drain down the countryside. And they thought it would be passing or entering Williamsburg at about noon. And this is before 8 o'clock in the morning. They had no idea that the reservoir was less than 10 minutes away. So Collins Graves goes down and he rides his dairy cart. He still has milk cans, you know, in his buggy.
And they're falling out. He's just clattering down the road.
Yeah,
here.
He's clattering down the road. The milk cans are falling out. Graves rides his buggy downstream, and he rides as close as he can to the mills, and he shouts, the Williamsburg Reservoir is giving way, the reservoir is giving way, and then begins shouting, to the hills, to the hills, to the hills. Then he went down to Skinnerville, and he warned the villagers in Skinnerville. He warned William Skinner, and he warned the factory workers at the silk mill. He was about 5 minutes ahead of the water at that time. And when he got to Haydenville, the next village, he was barely 2 minutes ahead of the water. And the water caught up to him in Haydenville. And this other man, Myron Day, at the bottom of Haydenville, looked up, saw the water coming into the village, and he's the one who took the alarm and raced further downstream with it to warn everybody that, oh my God, the reservoir is on its way. It's here.
Tell us what this wall of water was like. This was like a tsunami.
Yes, it was an extraordinary inland tidal wave. It was 20 to 40 feet high. At points, it was 300 feet wide. And it was a plow coming down the mountainside. So it was just churning up the entire country below it. And it was just filled with absolutely everything. It was filled with trees and mud and rocks and boulders, massive boulders that had been in place for centuries were uprooted by this wave. It was picking up mills, you know, farm animals, tools, people, children, everything in its path it picked up and took. And in regard to those who died in the flood, you either lived or you died. If you got caught in the waters, you died. If you escaped to the hillside, you lived. There were few people that were simply hurt. That water went through the upper villages in the valley of Williamsburg, Skinnerville, and Haydenville, and Leeds in 15 minutes each. And Skinnerville suffered the worst destruction of any village in the valley. They did say it had been obliterated from the face of the earth. It had been annihilated. It was a wasteland. It was an apocalyptic expanse of just sand and stones. And everything in Skinnerville was swept off and, you know, landed throughout the rest of the valley miles away.
I could almost hear the words going through his mind. I was born in poverty and now I've lost everything. I'm back in poverty. But that's not what happened. What was the immediate reaction of people to this terrible disaster that befell this man? And what did his character have to do with that?
Yeah, so Skinner was in complete shock once the disaster happened. You know, a neighbor overheard him muttering, "I worked for what I had, and now it is all gone." There wasn't a brick left of his silk mill. I mean, I was in New York City at 9. I lived in Manhattan during 9/11, and I remember that when those twin towers were gone, it was the hardest thing for me to get my head around the fact that they were gone. And that was the only thing that I could tap into to understand what Skinner might have experienced after the flood, because his huge silk mill, everything that he'd had, was gone. There was nothing left of it. You know, and he was in tremendous debt from that moment on, because he had the largest supply of raw silk on hand that he'd ever had, that was purchased entirely on credit. He was immediately in the hole. In those 15 minutes, he lost the equivalent today of $35 million.
What a story. We're talking with Sarah Skinner Kilborn about her book, American Phoenix. It's the remarkable story of her great-great-grandfather, William Skinner. Now, it turned out that he got an offer that he decided to take up to reestablish not too far away. It's just some 15 miles away down on the Connecticut River this time. Tell us a little bit about this offer.
Skinner began to receive offers from all over, and other manufacturers began to receive offers from all over. Offers were coming in from as far away as Omaha, Nebraska. The best offers were coming in from Holyoke. It was considered to have a greater potential for success than Lowell, Massachusetts. At that one area, the Connecticut River falls about 60 feet and is theoretically able to generate about 30,000 horsepower, which is just a phenomenal amount of power that could theoretically power hundreds of mills. That power is harnessed. The Connecticut River, this mighty, humongous river, you know, its power was harnessed and then funneled into a three-tiered canal system. So the water is not just flowing through one canal or being dissipated through a network of canals. It is being sent into a three-tiered system. Holyoke's canals are staggered down a slope, and the water from the Connecticut River is able to be used over three times. For a manufacturer like Skinner, Holyoke had just incredible appeal. The Williamsburg Reservoir, once it gave way, was never going to be rebuilt, and Skinner simply could not figure out how he was going to be able to rebuild in Skinnerville and be able to support an operation going forward, given that he was in such debt, he needed to climb out of the debt, and he couldn't take on more financial responsibilities. So he needed to figure out how to continue manufacturing the way that he'd been continuing to manufacture, meaning using water power, which is basically free, and go from there. And Holyoke came along and said, "Look, we will build you a mill, and you don't have to put a penny down for it. This is May of 1874. We'll have a mill built for you by the fall. And in January, you can only need to start paying us interest payments on that mill. And in 5 years, you can purchase the mill at its original cost. You can purchase the lot that it's being built on at its original cost." The lot was worth, I believe, $6,000. They also said, "We will give you rent-free property along the canals for 5 years. And we will give you an acre of land for free upon which to build a new house." So Skinner was basically offered the golden ticket.
And why? Why did Holyoke give him this incredibly generous offer? What was in it for them?
You know, Skinner's mill was one of the largest silk mills in the state. And it was these smaller manufacturers in Holyoke that were beginning to fill in the smaller lots along the canals. They had some huge mills, but they also wanted to fill in the smaller lots with these smaller mills. And so Skinner's was a smaller mill in comparison to the larger cotton mills and would fit just beautifully into the growing landscape of the city. But, you know, Skinner's silk mill was not the biggest fish to catch in the Mill River Valley. The largest fish to catch there was the Brass Works in Haydenville, which was one of the largest in the country. And the water power company really wanted the Haydenville Brass Works to move and to rebuild in Holyoke. And they went after Joel Hayden Jr., who was the president of the company, quite hard, and apparently they made him better offers than they made Skinner. but Hayden turned them down, and Skinner didn't. That was the turning point in both of those men's careers, because Joel Hayden Jr. went into bankruptcy, unable to rebuild the mill in Haydenville successfully, and Skinner went to Holyoke and was able to build on this new foundation, was able to get the ground back underneath him as he rebuilt, since he didn't have to worry about all of the expenses going into starting up a manufactory. He was able to have somebody else carry the weight of those expenses, and he just had to figure out how to continue on with his business and build it. So he was able to get out of debt with a new structure that was also the structure of his dreams. The contractors said, you know, essentially, so what kind of mill do you want? And Skinner drew out the mill that he wanted. You know, there was land to expand in Holyoke. It was the sky's the limit, you know, in terms of what he could ever possibly have. As opposed to in Skinnerville, you know, there was a limit to how big the mill could grow, because there was only so much power that he was going to be able to draw off of the Mill River. So Skinner chose to go to Holyoke, and none of the other manufacturers did.
Well, it is a fascinating story. The book is an absolute page-turner. I so hugely enjoyed reading it. It's American Phoenix, the remarkable story of William Skinner, the man who turned disaster into destiny. We've been talking with Skinner's great-great-granddaughter, Sarah Skinner Kilborn. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Francesca.
I spoke with Sarah Skinner Kilborn for nearly an hour. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the entire interview. Next up, Drew Adamek talks with labor studies scholar and folk musician Tom Jurevich. Stay tuned after the break.
I grew up at a time when a man could make his own fate by the sweat of his brow, by the work he'd do, by what his hands could make. Now my life hangs in the balance, deals brokered, made in sand. Far from this town, my fate is sealed at the altar of the bottom line. I should have seen it coming. How was I supposed to know? Record production coming out of the plant, past 3 years in a row. And they bought that place in New Hampshire, wasn't much of a find. What are we workers supposed to know about the altar of the bottom line? Though their debt kept rising, still they were not afraid. They built a series of overseas plants using the machines we made. But as greed it blinded all reason, startup fell way behind time. But next quarter they'd have to ante up at the altar of the bottom line.
I'm Drew Adamek. That was the title track from Professor Tom Jurevich's latest album, Altar of the Bottom Line. You can find that and Jurevich's other albums on iTunes or on his website, tomjurevich.com. Since the 1970s, jobs in the industrial, manufacturing, and textile industries have suffered a deep and probably irreversible decline. The Connecticut River Valley has been particularly hard hit by the loss of sustainable working-class wage jobs. Communities along the Connecticut River are struggling to survive and to find a replacement for the industries and economic stability that supported the area for nearly 200 years. This middle-class catastrophe isn't unique to the Connecticut River Valley, but as the birthplace of American industry, the Connecticut River Valley stands as a powerful symbol for the loss of sustainable industrial work in America today. Tom Jurevich is a professor of labor studies and sociology at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He has studied labor and unionization in the Connecticut River Valley for decades. His work examines, in part, the loss of industrial jobs and the impact that deindustrialization has on the working class. He is also an accomplished musician with 3 albums out. I talked to Professor Jurevich to find out how so many jobs have been lost in the last several decades, the impact that this has had on communities of the Connecticut River Valley, and what, if anything, can be done to reverse that decline. Thank you so much for joining us, Tom.
You're very welcome. Great to be here.
I spoke to a historian earlier in the show who called the Connecticut River and its tributary towns sort of the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution. What is that relationship like in your mind between the river and the birth of American industry like?
Well, I think we need to step back, and you know, I think we often look at the Connecticut River as a source of transportation or recreation, but I think we need to remember that it was water power that fueled the Industrial Revolution in the U.S. And when this began, you know, in places like Waltham and Lowell and Lawrence, but quickly moved to the Connecticut Valley as well, in towns like Turner's Falls or in Holyoke. And what I think we need to remember is that these were planned industrial communities to exploit water power. And in each of these, there's a series of canals. And the canals, the Power Canal in Turner's Falls and the series of upper and lower canals in Holyoke, weren't used for transportation. But they were used as the sources, the energy sources, for the factories that grew in those towns.
And what influence did that the geography of these towns and their use of water power? What influence did that have on the creation of American industrial power? What kind of industries were created as a result of where they were?
Well, it's very interesting. If we start north, first in Turner's Falls, and again, the power canal that diverts water from the Connecticut River, and then the water would fall from those from the power canal in the basement of those factories and power turbines that would then power. And the John Russell Cutlery was, in fact, at one point, the largest cutlery in North America. And it created the knives and the forks that were part of becoming, in some ways, a civilized American society. The Bowie knife was created in Turner's Falls and later in Greenfield. So these were very important parts of the industry. The two other threads that we need to follow in the Connecticut River Valley, the most important being that it quickly became a machine tool capital of North America. And machine tools, those are the tools that are used to make other tools. Capital goods, as the economists call them, were part of a thriving economy later, all the way from Springfield, Vermont, all the way through Connecticut. And the Connecticut Valley was indeed a leader in those machine tools, which then built the machines to fuel the rest of the economy.
In this early industrial period along the Connecticut River and its canals and tributaries, what kind of life and what kind of work life would the working class have in that time period?
Well, you know, it's very interesting because in many ways this factory system early on, again at Lowell and Lawrence, and later in the Connecticut River Valley, really created a working class for the first time. I mean, yes, there were artisans and small shops throughout the Connecticut River Valley, but it was really these large-scale factories that employed hundreds and in some cases thousands that created a new working class. And interesting to look at the transformation of that, too, because early on, the first workers in Lowell and Lawrence were some of the young women off the farms, and that happened true in the Connecticut Valley as well. But later on, we saw an influx of immigrants, and that changed in many ways the experience of workers. So I think I should back up maybe a little bit to note that also we need to remember that, you know, during the 19th century, you know, we didn't have controls on the economy, and there were a series of booms and busts. In fact, that's what happened in Holyoke. Holyoke was sort of the latest of the planned industrial communities and was hoping to become a textile center like Lowell and Lawrence, and instead became a paper city. really created a paper industry that put Holyoke and the Pioneer Valley on the map. And again, early on, those were local workers working, but increasingly those were immigrant workers. And with the immigrant workers and with these economic recessions and depressions, the conditions worsened in those factories. And those were big struggles, and those were big struggles for many of the immigrant workers. And we saw, in some ways, workers respond by forming unions in the Connecticut Valley.
As the American economy moved west and moved into the Midwest at the turn of the 20th century, rather, how did that impact the Connecticut River and the Connecticut River Valley and the economy and the labor force here as things moved westward?
Well, it's a complicated story. I think the first thing we need to note was, with the large-scale production of electricity, water power became, sadly, something of the past. We have to, in today's economy, look back and note that, this early industrial revolution in New England was a green revolution in terms of using water power and the siting of factories used natural light. So the first loss we saw in the Connecticut Valley was the loss of the use of water power. And we had, as I say, a flourishing machine tool industry into the 1970s, and it was really in the 1980s that went into crisis. And I think what we really lost in the Connecticut River Valley was a core industry that drove the economy. These were the places that were both skilled workers and unskilled workers. They were a place for a lot of American men and women in these industries who could then go on to have a house, to have a family, to contribute to their community. And that loss was devastating and continues to be devastating, because despite the talk in Massachusetts of these jobs being replaced by high-tech jobs and new advanced technological jobs, they have largely been replaced by jobs in the service industry, jobs that pay poorly, have a few job ladders, have few benefits, and make it very difficult for people to have the kind of life that workers for two generations in the Connecticut Valley expected.
And I want to go back to that because I think it's really important. And this idea of the Connecticut River Valley and the decline of industrial or blue-collar or middle-class work as a symbol for what's happening in the country as a whole.
Absolutely. And, in many ways, what happened in New England and in the Connecticut Valley in particular, in many ways, was the canary in the mine. It foreshadowed what we'd see later continue throughout the country. Again, because we had the oldest mills, and some of them, because they were built in the era of bricks and timber, they didn't have large floor plans and so on and so forth. And there were many reasons why many of the industries along the Connecticut Valley were the first to be industrialized. But yeah, absolutely. We saw that the beginning here in the Connecticut Valley, what would become a national issue, and one that we actually still seeing, the tail end of today as we watch, much of manufacturing being wildly challenged. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released the numbers on unionization. And in the private sector manufacturing, unionization now has dropped to 6.3%. And that's the lowest number in 97 years. And I think what goes with that, again, is that what the unions brought to the Connecticut Valley and what they brought to Americans were an ability for working people to have some equity. And with that drop in unionization rate, we've seen a growing income inequality. And that's not only bad for the workers themselves, but that's bad for our communities. And I guess we've seen that in the deterioration of these once brilliant, beautiful industrial towns along the Connecticut River.
What kind of industry replaced these sort of sustainable, economically viable jobs in places like the Connecticut River Valley?
The truth is that the industrial manufacturing that was done in the Connecticut River Valley was never replaced. There was not an industry that stepped in its place. I mean, if we look at a town like Turner's Falls or Greenfield or Holyoke, yes, we've seen the malls, we've seen the retail, but those only provide a fraction of the kind of jobs that were provided by industry, and also jobs that aren't really family wage jobs, jobs that provide for people to have the expectation of a solid American life. So really, we didn't see the replacement, and I think that's when you look at the numbers, the largest single occupation in Massachusetts is retail sales. And again, I think that really speaks to the fact that while retail in numbers has in some ways replaced jobs, those aren't really occupations. Not in the same way that when one entered Greenfield Tap and Die or Miller's Falls Tool or one of the many paper companies in Holyoke, these were jobs for a life. These are jobs for a lifetime, and they were allowed someone to have what we so many times call the American dream. And not that these jobs were easy, not that they were dangerous and dirty and difficult, but at the end of the day, the unions provided some sense of dignity on the job and some ability to have a decent American life.
I grew up in a town. I grew up in Waukegan, Illinois, where my grandfather and my father, when you graduated from high school, you went down to the lakefront. You applied at every job until you got one, at every factory, and then you stayed there till you retired. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, and my father all did that. That's not an option for me. The question in here is then, what is the prognosis for a place like the Connecticut River Valley with a very strong industrial history and a strong industrial background, now that those jobs are gone and probably not coming back?
Well, you know, I think the other thing that we need to remember is that, you know, the skills that workers had in those jobs were a source of tremendous pride among working class people in the Connecticut Valley. Their ability to work in these factories, to have this skill and this knowledge. And while we sometimes think of these as unskilled jobs, I think when we step back, that really was a skill. And it was a skill that also working class men and women passed down from themselves to their kids. And exactly that pattern, that they would be replaced by their sons and their daughters along the Connecticut Valley. So I think with the loss of those jobs, it's also a loss, really, in identity. And not that one can't take pride in being the best clerk at a Walmart, but I think it's different. And so I think that it's created both an economic crisis and, in some ways, I would argue, in some ways, a cultural crisis. And I wish I could be more optimistic about the economy, but having spent quite a long time examining this, what we've seen are the replacement of good industrial jobs with jobs that are okay for young people at entry level, but not jobs that would bring the Connecticut River back to what it was. And I think that I think we have to say that clearly. And yes, there's ability for small startups and other kinds of interesting things along this beautiful river. But in terms of, we've really got to replace those industries with something that's going to be the home for both unskilled and skilled workers for generations to come.
And I apologize for circling around, but you said something that's very, I think, important, not only sort of macro picture, but to this series. You mentioned that the industrial towns and the industrial culture of the Connecticut River Valley created communities.
Yes.
Will you talk a little bit about that and what the loss of that sense of community based around labor and work and the economy of this area?
In the post-war era, you know, along the Connecticut River Valley, these were very strong communities. And they were strong communities for a whole variety of reasons. Their unions brought a culture of working class pride and dignity to these towns. There were ethnic groups, different ethnicities, and their own communities within these industrial towns. And there was, a growing sense of civic pride. And, you know, that goes back to the old ancient notion in New England we have here of the citizen, of, the farmer who plows his field in the morning and writes his poetry in the afternoon. There was a strong notion of citizenship in these towns, and these towns worked and they prospered. And, you know, when the economic floor fell out, it just became very difficult for these kinds of communities to keep together in the same way. And not that there was only one community, there were many communities within communities, but this created a real crisis at the community level. Just if you even think about this, imagine the unionized factory worker who brought home his salary, had his protections on the job. When that person lost his job and then had to cobble together two jobs, you know, maybe working 10 or 12 hours a day or 50 or 60 hours a week, how is that person supposed to participate in their kid's softball team and the Boy Scouts, in their ethnic community civic association? And I think that in this economy now where people either aren't working or working way too much in jobs that may not deliver the same kind of economic value they did, is that that is at the root of some of the struggles that the communities along the Connecticut River are facing. Without that economic base, very difficult to hold on to those same notions of community.
I want to play devil's advocate for just a moment. We've heard a lot about the decline of the industrial middle class and the working class,
mm-hmm.
but the popular prognosis is that high tech green jobs are going to replace that and create this sort of new working class. And you mentioned earlier that the original industry here was a green industry. Does that hold true here in the Connecticut River Valley, that green industries and high-tech industries are going to replace these jobs that we've lost, or is that not something that we're seeing?
Well, I think that there's a beautiful dream of revival in the Connecticut Valley, and imagine once again letting in Turner's Falls, they called the power canal white coal. That powered these factories. Imagine turning on the spigot again and again, using a new technology to both generate electricity and the kinds of energy that we need for industrial production. And I think that there's some great possibilities for a revival of these communities. But I think here's the dilemma. The dilemma right now is that when we look currently at high-tech or green energy, while there's a great promise that we're really talking about, and although we look sometimes at those numbers and there seems to be lots of growth in percentage, there's not a lot of occupations yet in those industries. And the high-tech industry, what we also saw was, you know, despite the Massachusetts miracle, what we saw was that not only could manufacturing jobs be offshored and outsourced, but so could high-tech jobs. And that, I think, was the sort of the fallacy that we were going to become the brains of the world and other people were going to produce products. Well, in fact, you know, huge numbers of companies, India, China, and places throughout the global south are producing huge numbers of engineers, computer folks, and very highly skilled technical people. So there's a dilemma we face here. So right now we're not up to the scope and scale that high tech and green energy is going to do. But I also want to just step back for a minute and note that I think we also need to look at what's happening in the Connecticut River Valley and what happened in the Connecticut River Valley as not just like the flow of the river, some natural evolution. What happened in this valley were the discrete decision makers of both people in power in the financial sector and people in the government, in a state, in the Commonwealth, and in these communities. So I think that it's not a case of just letting green energy or high tech happen. I think what we need to do in the state is really create a new industrial economy by actually providing incentives and building a public policy to create these kinds of jobs and these kinds of industries. So I don't think that the private sector is by itself going to deliver that to the Connecticut River. Connecticut River Valley, I have my doubts. But I do think that we need to work really hard to develop the potential and to build the policies and incentives for these kinds of industries to flourish along these shores.
To what you just said, what are the positive resources and positive attributes of this area, of the Connecticut River Valley, that we can use to go forward to help rebuild or reestablish, if it's possible, a working class or a sustainable economic system?
Well, I would count three. The first one is that despite the fact that when people drive through Turner's Falls or Holyoke, people see lots of ruin and neglect, I would argue there's still an infrastructure there. There's an infrastructure that creates a base for opportunity We're beginning to see that a bit in Holyoke with a new server being located there and so on. So I think there's some, so there's an infrastructure possibility. The other thing is partly because of these planned industrial communities and the housing stock and so on, is that I think that there are ways in which these are still beautiful, beautiful communities. And with some sense of economic development, there can be some beautiful revivals. So I think there's that infrastructure base. I also don't think that, I think that we shouldn't also forget that along these shores we also have a fine university and a number of excellent colleges. And there's an intellectual capital that's in the Pioneer Valley that I think is strong and is can be central to a kind of revival of economic revival along the river. And third, I think we also just have to look at the kinds of communities that have developed along the river. And despite the decline, despite the economic devastation in some of these communities, we still have some strong community forces and a strong workforce. And we've had, you know, really from the very beginning of this and an early industrial revolution and before, experiments at innovation and alternatives, going back to the early experiment in Florence of the Association for Education and Industry, an early utopian community. So we've had these visions in the Pioneer Valley, and I think that that can be once again the source of economic innovation along the shores of the Connecticut River.
So thank you so much for joining us, Tom.
All right, thank you very much.
You've been listening to an episode of The River Runs Through Us, part of our six-part series that examines the literature, spirit, and meaning of the Connecticut River. Funded by a generous grant from Mass Humanities, The River Runs Through Us examines contemporary challenges through the creative, metaphorical, and historical lens of the Connecticut River. We engage writers, artists, and scholars in a long-form public conversation to take a deep and literate look at issues that often get short shrift in the media. Thanks to Mass Humanities for their kind support.
And right now, we need your help to continue the project. We need to raise $600 to fulfill the conditions of our grant and to cover our costs. It's not a lot, and it's the first time we've ever asked you for money. But right now, we really need you. Please head on over to Kickstarter and search on Writer's Voice, River Runs Through Us to donate. Or go to writersvoice.net for a link. Any contribution is greatly appreciated. Thanks so much for your support.
No, it's not finished. No, it's not through. How much more will we let them ruin? What will it all come to? The time it now passes, though everything isn't fine. Many more will be sacrificed at the altar of the bottom line. I grew up at a time when a man could make his own
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.